Black Clock Audio Tales 2019, Mary Shelley. Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out the brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers make a roaring sound every three steps. Made with green, scaly-looking fabric that's actually a soft plush. Foam footbeds, non-slip grips on your sole so you don't slip around. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 9. Footbed measures 10.5 inches. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter or two at a time, or a couple of short stories, maybe some folklore. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us at the end of the month, every last Tuesday of the month, where we have The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, where you get to hear me talk in a lot more dumb voices than right now. Look for us wherever you look for podcasts, rate, review, and give us 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 stars. We don't like the 1 and 2 stars, but hey, if that's how you feel, you probably have a vendetta against us and don't know how to use the skip button. We are on the Instagram, the Facebook, and the Twitter as Black Clock Audio Tales, or just Google us, Black Clock Audio Tales. There's no one else named that, otherwise we wouldn't name it this. Thank you, and let's get going with The Last Man by Mary Shelley.
Recording by Madeira. The Last Man by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. Volume 2, Chapter 4. I returned to my family estate in the autumn of the year 2092. My heart had long been with them, and I felt sick with the hope and delight of seeing them again. The district which contained them appeared the abode of every kindly spirit. Happiness, love, and peace walked the forest paths and tempered the atmosphere. After all the agitation and sorrow I had endured in Greece, I sought Windsor, as the storm-driven bird does the nest in which it may fold its wings in tranquility. How unwise had the wanderers been, who had deserted its shelter, entangled themselves in the web of society, and entered on what men of the world call life, that labyrinth of evil, that scheme of mutual torture. To live, according to this sense of the word, we must not only observe and learn, we must also feel. We must not be mere spectators of action, we must act. We must not describe, but be subjects of description. Deep sorrow must have been the inmate of our bosoms. Fraud must have lain in wait for us. The artful must have deceived us. Sickening doubt and false hope must have checkered our days. Hilarity and joy, that lap the soul in ecstasy, must at times have possessed us. Who that knows what life is would pine for this feverish species of existence? I have lived. I have spent days and nights of festivity. I have joined in ambitious hopes and exulted in victory. Now, shut the door on the world and build high the wall that is to separate me from the troubled scene enacted within its precincts. Let us live for each other and for happiness. Let us seek peace in our dear home, near the inland murmur of streams and the gracious waving of trees, the beauteous vesture of earth and sublime pageantry of the skies. Let us leave life that we may live. Idris was well content with this resolve of mine. Her native sprightliness needed no undue excitement, and her placid heart reposed contented on my love, the well-being of her children, and the beauty of surrounding nature. Her pride and blameless ambition was to create smiles in all around her, and to shed repose on the fragile existence of her brother. In spite of her tender nursing, the health of Adrian perceptibly declined. Walking, riding, the common occupations of life overcame him. He felt no pain, but seemed to tremble forever on the verge of annihilation. Yet, as he had lived on for months nearly in the same state, he did not inspire us with any immediate fear. And though he talked of death as an event most familiar to his thoughts, he did not cease to exert himself to render others happy or to cultivate his own astonishing powers of mind. Winter passed away, and spring, led by the months, awakened life in all nature. The forest was dressed in green. The young calves frisked on the new-sprung grass. The wind-winged shadows of light clouds sped over the green cornfields. The hermit cuckoo repeated his monotonous "All hail" to the season. The nightingale, bird of love and minion of the evening star, filled the woods with song, while Venus lingered in the warm sunset, and the young green of the trees lay in gentle relief along the clear horizon. Delight awoke in every heart. Delight and exultation, for there was peace through all the world. The temple of universal Janus was shut, and man died not that year by the hand of man. "Let this last but 12 months," said Adrian, "and earth will become a paradise. The energies of man were before directed to the destruction of his species. They now aim at its liberation and preservation. Man cannot repose, and his restless aspirations will now bring forth good instead of evil. The favored countries of the south will throw off the iron yoke of servitude. Poverty will quit us, and with that sickness. What may not the forces, never before ununited, of liberty and peace achieve in this dwelling of man?"
"Dreaming, forever dreaming, Windsor," said Ryland, the old adversary of Raymond and candidate for the protectorate at the ensuing election. "Be assured that earth is not, nor ever can be, heaven, while the seeds of hell are natives of her soil. When the seasons have become equal, when the air breeds no disorders, when its surface is no longer liable to blights and droughts, then sickness will cease. When men's passions are dead, poverty will depart. When love is no longer akin to hate, then brotherhood will exist. We are very far from that state at present."
"Not so very far, as you may suppose,"
observed a little old astronomer, by name Merrivale.
"The poles proceed slowly, but securely, and in 100,000 years
we shall all be underground,"
said Ryland.
"The pole of the earth will coincide with the pole of the ecliptic,"
continued the astronomer,
"and universal spring will be produced, and earth become a paradise."
"And we shall, of course, enjoy the benefit of the change,"
said Ryland contemptuously. "We have strange news here," I observed. I had the newspaper in my hand, and, as usual, had turned to the intelligence from Greece. "It seems that the total destruction of Constantinople and the supposition that winter has purified the air of the fallen city gave the Greeks courage to visit its site and begin to rebuild it. But they tell us that the curse of God is on the place, for everyone who has ventured within the walls has been tainted by the plague. That this disease has spread in Thrace and Macedonia. Well, and now, fearing the virulence of infection during the coming heats, a cordon has been drawn on the frontiers of Thessaly, and a strict quarantine exacted." This intelligence brought us back from the prospect of paradise, held out after the lapse of 100,000 years to the pain and misery at present existent upon earth. We talked of the ravages made last year by pestilence in every quarter of the world, and of the dreadful consequences of a second visitation. We discussed the best means of preventing infection and of preserving health and activity in a large city thus afflicted, London, for instance. Merrivale did not join in this conversation. Drawing near Idris, he proceeded to assure her that the joyful prospect of an earthly paradise after 100,000 years was clouded to him by the knowledge that in a certain period of time after, an earthly hell or purgatory would occur, when the ecliptic and equator would be at right angles. Our party at length broke up.
"We are all dreaming this morning," said Ryland. "It is as wise to discuss the probability of a visitation of the plague in our well-governed metropolis as to calculate the centuries which must escape before we can grow pineapples here in the open air."
But though it seemed absurd to calculate upon the arrival of the plague in London, I could not reflect without extreme pain on the desolation this evil would cause in Greece. The English, for the most part, talked of Thrace and Macedonia, as they would of a lunar territory which unknown to them, presented no distinct idea or interest to the minds. I had trod the soil. The faces of many of the inhabitants were familiar to me. In the towns, plains, hills, and defiles of these countries, I had enjoyed unspeakable delight. As I journeyed through them the year before, some romantic village, some cottage, or elegant abode there situated, inhabited by the lovely and the good, rose before my mental sight, and the question haunted me. Is the plague there also? That same invincible monster which hovered over and devoured Constantinople, that fiend more cruel than tempest, less tame than fire, is, alas, unchained in that beautiful country. These reflections would not allow me to rest. The political state of England became agitated as the time drew near when the new protector was to be elected. This event excited the more interest, since it was the current report, that if the popular candidate, Ryland, should be chosen, the question of the abolition of hereditary rank and other feudal relics would come under the consideration of Parliament. Not a word had been spoken during the present session of any of these topics. Everything would depend upon the choice of a protector and the elections of the ensuing year. Yet this very silence was awful, shewing the deep weight attributed to the question. The fear of either party to hazard an ill-timed attack, and the expectation of a furious contention when it should begin. But although St. Stephen's did not echo with the voice which filled each heart, the newspapers teemed with nothing else. And in private companies, the conversation, however remotely begun, soon verged toward this central point, while voices were lowered and chairs drawn closer. The nobles did not hesitate to express their fear. The other party endeavored to treat the matter lightly.
"Shame on the country," said Ryland, "to lay so much stress upon words and frippery. It is a question of nothing, of the new painting of carriage panels and the embroidery of footmen's coats."
Yet could England indeed doff her lordly trappings and be content with the democratic style of America? Were the pride of ancestry, the patrician spirit, the gentle courtesies and refined pursuits, splendid attributes of rank to be erased among us? We were told that this would not be the case, that we were by nature a poetical people, a nation easily duped by words, ready to array clouds in splendor and bestow honor on the dust. This spirit we could never lose. And it was to diffuse this concentrated spirit of birth that the new law was to be brought forward. We were assured that when the name and title of Englishman was the sole patent of nobility, we should all be noble, that when no man born under English sway felt another his superior in rank, courtesy and refinement would become the birthright of all our countrymen. Let not England be so far disgraced as to have it imagined that it can be without nobles nature's true nobility, who bear their patent in their mien, who are from their cradle elevated above the rest of their species, because they are better than the rest. Among a race of independent and generous and well-educated men, in a country where the imagination is empress of men's minds, there needs be no fear that we should want a perpetual succession of the high-born and lordly. That party, however, could hardly yet be considered a minority in the kingdom, who extolled the ornament of the column, the Corinthian capital of polished society. They appealed to prejudices without number, to old attachments and young hopes, to the expectation of thousands who might one day become peers. They set up as a scarecrow the specter of all that was sordid, mechanic, and base in the commercial republics. The plague had come to Athens. Hundreds of English residents returned to their own country. Raymond's beloved Athenians, the free, the noble people of the divinest town in Greece, fell like ripe corn before the merciless sickle of the adversary. Its pleasant places were deserted. Its temples and palaces were converted into tombs. Its energies, bent before towards the highest objects of human ambition, were now forced to converge to one point: the guarding against the innumerous arrows of the plague. At any other time, this disaster would have excited extreme compassion among us, but it was now passed over, while each mind was engaged by the coming controversy. It was not so with me, and the question of rank and right dwindled to insignificance in my eyes when I pictured the scene of suffering Athens. I heard of the death of only sons, of wives and husbands most devoted, of the rending of ties twisted with the heart's fibers, of friend losing friend, and young mothers mourning for their firstborn, and these moving incidents were grouped and painted in my mind by the knowledge of the persons, by my esteem and affection for the sufferers. It was the admirers, friends, fellow soldiers of Raymond, families that had welcomed Perdita to Greece, and lamented with her the loss of her lord, that were swept away, and went to dwell with them in the undistinguishing tomb. The plague at Athens had been preceded and caused by the contagion from the east, and the scene of havoc and death continued to be acted there on a scale of fearful magnitude. A hope that the visitation of the present year would prove the last kept up the spirits of the merchants connected with these countries, but the inhabitants were driven to despair, or to a resignation which, arising from fanaticism, assumed the same dark hue. America had also received the taint, and, were it yellow fever or plague, the epidemic was gifted with a virulence before unfelt. The devastation was not confined to the towns, but spread throughout the country. The hunter died in the woods, the peasant in the cornfields, and the fisher on his native waters. A strange story was brought to us from the east, to which little credit would have been given had not the fact been attested by a multitude of witnesses in various parts of the world. On the 21st of June, it was said that an hour before noon, a black sun arose, an orb the size of that luminary, but dark, defined, whose beams were shadows, ascended from the west. In about an hour it had reached the meridian, and eclipsed the bright parent of day. Night fell upon every country, night sudden, rayless, entire. The stars came out, shedding their ineffectual glimmerings on the light-widowed earth. But soon the dim orb passed from over the sun and lingered down the eastern heaven. As it descended, its dusky rays crossed the brilliant ones of the sun and deadened or distorted them. The shadows of things assumed strange and ghastly shapes. The wild animals in the woods took fright at the unknown shapes figured on the ground. They fled, they knew not whither, and the citizens were filled with greater dread at the convulsion which shook lions into civil streets. Birds, strong-winged eagles, suddenly blinded, fell in the marketplaces, while owls and bats shooed themselves, welcoming the early night. Gradually the object of fear sank beneath the horizon, and to the last shot up shadowy beams into the otherwise radiant air. Such was the tale sent us from Asia, from the eastern extremity of Europe, and from Africa as far west as the Golden Coast. Whether this story were true or not, the effects were certain. Through Asia, from the banks of the Nile to the shores of the Caspian, from the Hellespont, even to the Sea of Oman, a sudden panic was driven. The men filled the mosques, the women veiled, hastened to the tombs, and carried offerings to the dead, thus to preserve the living. The plague was forgotten in this new fear which the black sun had spread, and, though the dead multiplied, and the streets of Isfahan, of Peking, and of Delhi were strewed with pestilence-struck corpses, men passed on, gazing on the ominous sky, regardless of the death beneath their feet. The Christians sought their churches, Christian maidens, even at the Feast of Roses, clad in white, with shining veils, sought in long procession the places consecrated to their religion, filling the air with their hymns, while ever and anon, from the lips of some poor mourner in the crowd, a voice of wailing burst, and the rest looked up, fancying they could discern the sweeping wings of angels, who passed over the earth, lamenting the disasters about to fall on man. In the sunny clime of Persia, in the crowded cities of China, amidst the aromatic groves of Kashmir, and along the southern shores of the Mediterranean, such scenes had place. Even in Greece, the tale of the sun of darkness increased the fears and despair of the dying multitude. We, in our cloudy isle, were far removed from danger, and the only circumstance that brought these disasters at all home to us was the daily arrival of vessels from the east, crowded with emigrants, mostly English. For the Moslems, though the fear of death was spread keenly among them, still clung together. That, if they were to die, and if they were, death would as readily beat them on the homeless sea or in far England as in Persia. If they were to die, their bones might rest in earth made sacred by the relics of true believers. Mecca had never before been so crowded with pilgrims, yet the Arabs neglected to pillage the caravans, but humble and weaponless, they joined the procession, praying Muhammad to avert plague from their tents and deserts. I cannot describe the rapturous delight with which I turned from political brawls at home and the physical evils of distant countries to my own dear home, to the selected abode of goodness and love, to peace and the interchange of every sacred sympathy. Had I never quitted Windsor, these emotions would not have been so intense, but I had in Greece been the prey of fear and deplorable change. In Greece, after a period of anxiety and sorrow, I had seen depart two whose very names were the symbol of greatness and virtue. But such miseries could never intrude upon the domestic circle left to me. While secluded in our beloved forest, we passed our lives in tranquility. Some small change indeed the progress of years brought here. And time, as it is wont, stamped the traces of mortality on our pleasures and expectations. Idris, the most affectionate wife, sister, and friend, was a tender and loving mother. The feeling was not with her, as with many, a pastime. It was a passion. We had had three children. One, the second in age, died while I was in Greece. This had dashed the triumphant and rapturous emotions of maternity with grief and fear. Before this event, the little being sprung from herself, the young heirs of her transient life, seemed to have a sure lease of existence. Now she dreaded that the pitiless destroyer might snatch her remaining darlings, as it had snatched their brother. The least illness caused throes of terror. She was miserable if she were at all absent from them. Her treasure of happiness she had garnered in their fragile being, and kept forever on the watch, lest the insidious thief should, as before, steal these valued gems. She had fortunately small cause for fear. Alfred, now 9 years old, was an upright, manly little fellow, with radiant brow, soft eyes, and gentle, though independent, disposition. Our youngest was yet in infancy, but his downy cheek was sprinkled with the roses of health, and his unwearied vivacity filled our halls with innocent laughter. Clara had passed the age which, from its mute ignorance, was the source of the fears of Idris. Clara was dear to her, to all. There was so much intelligence combined with innocence, sensibility with forbearance, and seriousness with perfect good humor, a beauty so transparent, united to such endearing simplicity, that she hung like a pearl in the shrine of our possessions, a treasure of wonder and excellence. At the beginning of winter, our Alfred, now 9 years of age, first went to school at Eton. This appeared to him the primary step towards manhood, and he was proportionably pleased. Community of study and amusement developed the best parts of his character, his steady perseverance, generosity, and well-governed firmness. What deep and sacred emotions are excited in a father's bosom when he first becomes convinced that his love for his child is not a mere instinct, but worthily bestowed, and that others, less akin, participate his approbation? It was supreme happiness to Idris and myself to find that the frankness which Alfred's open brow indicated, the intelligence of his eyes, the tempered sensibility of his tones, were not delusions, but indications of talents and virtues which would grow with his growth and strengthen with his strength. At this period, the termination of an animal's love for its offspring, the true affection of the human parent, commences. We no longer look on this dearest part of ourselves as a tender plant which we must cherish, or a plaything for an idle hour. We build now on his intellectual faculties. We establish our hopes on his moral propensities. His weakness still imparts anxiety to this feeling. His ignorance prevents entire intimacy, but we begin to respect the future man, and to endeavor to secure his esteem, even as if he were our equal. What can a parent have more at heart than the good opinion of his child? In all our transactions with him, our honor must be inviolate, the integrity of our relations untainted. Fate and circumstance may, when he arrives at maturity, separate us forever, but as his age is in danger, his consolation in hardship, let the ardent youth forever bear with him through the rough path of life, love and honor for his parents. We had lived so long in the vicinity of Eton that its population of young folks was well known to us. Many of them had been Alfred's playmates before they became his schoolfellows. We now watched this youthful congregation with redoubled interest. We marked the difference of character among the boys and endeavored to read the future man in the stripling. There is nothing more lovely, to which the heart more yearns than a free-spirited boy, gentle, brave, and generous. Several of the Etonians had these characteristics. All were distinguished by a sense of honor and spirit of enterprise. In some, as they verged towards manhood, this degenerated into presumption. But the younger ones, lads a little older than our own, were conspicuous for their gallant and sweet dispositions. Here were the future governors of England, the men who, when our ardor was cold and our projects completed or destroyed forever, when our drama acted, we doffed the garb of the hour and assumed the uniform of age or of more equalizing death. Here were the beings who were to carry on the vast machine of society. Here were the lovers, husbands, fathers. Here the landlord, the politician, the soldier. Some fancied that they were even now ready to appear on the stage, eager to make one among the dramatis personae of active life. It was not long since I was like one of these beardless aspirants. When my boy shall have obtained the place I now hold, I shall have tottered into a gray-headed, wrinkled old man. Strange system, riddle of the Sphinx, most awe-striking, that thus man remains while we the individuals pass away. Such is, to borrow the words of an eloquent and philosophic writer, the mode of existence decreed to a permanent body composed of transitory parts, wherein by the disposition of a stupendous wisdom, molding together the great mysterious incorporation of the human race, the whole at one time is never old or middle-aged or young, but in a condition of unchangeable constancy, moves on through the varied tenor of perpetual decay, fall, renovation, and progression. Willingly do I give place to thee, dear Alfred. Advance, offspring of tender love, child of our hopes, advance a soldier on the road to which I have been the pioneer. I will make way for thee. I have already put off the carelessness of childhood, the unlined brow and springy gait of early years, that they may adorn thee. Advance, and I will despoil myself still further for thy advantage. Time shall rob me of the graces of maturity, shall take the fire from my eyes and agility from my limbs, shall steal the better part of life, eager expectation and passionate love, and shower them in double portion on thy dear head. Advance! Avail thyself of the gift, thou and thy comrades. And in the drama you are about to act, do not disgrace those who taught you to enter on the stage and to pronounce becomingly the parts assigned to you. May your progress be uninterrupted and secure. Born during the springtide of the hopes of man, may you lead up the summer to which no winter may succeed. End of chapter 4.
Hey listeners, sorry for the interruption. More The Last Man coming up. But before that, I'd like to thank you for listening. We'd love to hear from you and your suggestions for future episodes and topic ideas at facebook.com/blackclockaudio. Help support the show by keeping it paywall-free by going to paypal.me/pgttcm and donate a buck or five to pgttcm.podbean.com and become a patron. We'll never ask you for your info or ask you to fill out a survey or just tell your friends about us. That's all we ask. Do you have no cash to donate? That's fine. Neither do we. Help the show by sharing, rating, liking, or five-star giving wherever you get your podcasts from. You can always buy a cool shirt from pgttcm.threadless.com. And if you're wondering, hey, what's all this PGTTCM stuff about? People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is our monthly end-of-the-month show where we talk to Cthulhu Mythos writers, game designers, talk about various aspects of the Cthulhu Mythos, going from the Big Bang to the cooling of our sun, just the whole kit and caboodle. From the perspective of Earthlings, of course. Next month is going to be Ambrose Bitterbierce, one of my favorite weird fiction authors who also wrote Civil War tales and spooky dookie stories, and also, you know, Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, that story your 8th or 9th grade English teacher made you read? Yeah, Ambrose Bierce, but we won't hold that against him. It's a good story, though. And in August, we're going to have Anyone But Derleth, Cthulhu Mythos, Non-Derlethian Mythos Stories, and more about August Derleth himself and Arkham House Publishing, and pretty much, I don't know, kind of talk about why everyone makes fun of August Derleth, but without him, there's some stuff that would be missing. September, Bronte. Oh yeah, it's going to be all about the Brontes. And, of course, we'll more than likely have Andrew Grace talking about the Brontes again, because Andrew Grace likes to talk about the Brontes. October, nothing but spooky stories that you can play all October long, and, ooh, maybe even December and November, when it's even darker and scarier. And November will be Old English Lit, so we're going to be doing stuff like Beowulf and stuff around that neck of the woods. Old English 800 Lit. It's that smooth, mellow lit that gives you more power. Old English 800 lit. And we don't have anything planned for December. But hey, if you want to pitch in your 2 cents or your, I don't know, opinion, we'll listen. We'll check it out. And if it's something that we can arrange, then it's something we can do. So your input is always appreciated. Thank you so much. And back to Mary Shelley's The Last Man.
Recording by Larry Maddox. The Last Man by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. Volume 2, Chapter 5. Some disorder had surely crept into the course of the elements, destroying their benignant influence. The wind, prince of air, raged through his kingdom, lashing the sea into fury, and subduing the rebel earth into some sort of obedience. The god sends down his angry plagues from high, famine and pestilence in heaps they die. Again in vengeance of his wrath he falls on their great host and breaks their tottering walls, arrests their navies on the ocean's plain, and whelms their strength with mountains of the main. Their deadly power shook the flourishing countries of the south, and during winter, even we, in our northern retreat, began to quake under their ill effects. That fable is unjust, which gives the superiority to the sun over the wind. Who has not seen the lightsome earth, the balmy atmosphere, and basking nature become dark, cold, and ungenial, when the sleeping wind has awoke in the east, or when the dun clouds thickly veil the sky, while the exhaustless stores of rain are poured down until the dank earth, refusing to imbibe the superabundant moisture, it lies in pools on the surface, when the torch of day seems like a meteor to be quenched. Who has not seen the cloud-stirring north arise, the streaked blue appear, and soon an opening made in the vapors in the eye of the wind, through which the bright azure shines. The clouds become thin, an arc is formed forever rising upwards, till, the universal cope being unveiled, the sun pours forth its rays, reanimated and fed by the breeze. Then mighty art thou, O wind, to be throned above all other vicegerents of nature's power. Whether thou comest destroying from the east, or pregnant with elementary life from the west, thee the clouds obey, the sun is subservient to thee, the shoreless ocean is thy slave. Thou sweepest over the earth, and oaks, the growth of centuries, submit to thy viewless axe. The snowdrift is scattered on the pinnacles of the Alps. The avalanche thunders down their valleys. Thou holdest the keys of the frost, and canst first chain and then set free the streams. Under thy gentle governance, the buds and leaves are born. They flourish, nursed by thee. Why dost thou howl thus, O wind, by day and by night? For 4 long months thy roarings have not ceased. The shores of the sea are strewn with wrecks. Its nil welcoming surface has become impassable. The earth has shed her beauty in obedience to thy command. The frail balloon dares no longer sail on the agitated air. Thy ministers, the clouds, deluge the land with rain. Rivers forsake their banks. The wild torrent tears up the mountain path, plain and wood, and verdant dell are despoiled of their loveliness. Our very cities are wasted by thee. Alas, what will become of us? It seems as if the giant waves of ocean and vast arms of the sea were about to wrench the deep-rooted island from its center and cast it, a ruin and a wreck, upon the fields of the Atlantic. What are we, the inhabitants of this globe, least among the many that people infinite space? Our minds embrace infinity. The visible mechanism of our being is subject to merest accident. Day by day we are forced to believe this. He whom a scratch has disorganized, he who disappears from apparent life under the influence of the hostile agency at work around us, had the same powers as I. I also am subject to the same laws. In the face of all this, we call ourselves lords of the creation, welders of the elements, masters of life and death, and we allege, in excuse of this arrogance, that though the individual is destroyed, man continues forever. Thus, losing our identity, that of which we are chiefly conscious, we glory in the continuity of our species and learn to regard death without terror. But when any whole nation becomes the victim of the destructive powers of exterior agents, then indeed man shrinks into insignificance. He feels his tenure of life insecure, his inheritance on earth cut off. I remember, after having witnessed the destructive effects of a fire, I could not even behold a small one in a stove without a sensation of fear. The mounting flames had curled around the building as it fell and was destroyed. They insinuated themselves into the substances about them, and the impediments to their progress yielded at their touch. Could we take integral parts of this power and not be subject to its operation? Could we domesticate a cub of this wild beast and not fear its growth and maturity? Thus we begin to feel with regard to many visaged death let loose on the chosen districts of our fair habitation, and above all with regard to the plague. We feared the coming summer. Nations bordering on the already infected countries begin to enter upon serious plans for the better keeping out of the enemy. We, a commercial people, were obliged to bring such schemes under consideration, and the question of contagion became matter of earnest disquisition. That the plague was not what is commonly called contagious, like the scarlet fever or extinct smallpox, was proved. It was called an epidemic. But the grand question was still unsettled of how this epidemic was generated and increased. If infection depended upon the air was subject to infection. As, for instance, a typhus fever has been brought by ships to one seaport town, yet the very people who brought it there were incapable of communicating it in a town more fortunately situated. But how are we to judge of errors and pronounce in such a city plague will die unproductive? In such another, nature has provided for it a plentiful harvest. In the same way, individuals may escape 99 times and receive the death blow at the 100th, because bodies are sometimes in a state to reject the infection of malady, and at others, thirsty to imbibe it. These reflections made our legislators pause before they could decide on the laws to be put in force. The evil was so wide-spreading, so violent and immedicable, that no care, no prevention could be judged superfluous, which even added a chance to our escape. These were questions of prudence. There was no immediate necessity for an earnest caution. England was still secure. France, Germany, Italy, and Spain were interposed, walls yet without a breach between us and the plague. Our vessels truly were the sport of winds and waves, even as Gulliver was the toy of the Brobdignagians. But we, on our stable abode, could not be hurt in life or limb by these eruptions of nature. We could not fear, we did not, yet a feeling of awe, a breathless sentiment of wonder, a painful sense of the degradation of humanity was introduced into every heart. Nature, our mother and our friend, had turned on us a brow of menace. She showed us plainly that though she permitted us to assign her laws and subdue her apparent powers, yet if she put forth a finger, we must quake. She could take out our globe, fringed with mountains girded by atmosphere containing the condition of our being, and all that man's mind could invent or his force achieve, she could take the ball in her hand and cast it into space where life would be drunk up, and man and all his efforts forever annihilated. These speculations were rife among us, yet not the less we proceeded in our daily occupations and our plans, whose accomplishment demanded the lapse of many years. No voice was heard telling us to hold. When foreign distresses came to be felt by us through the channels of commerce, we set ourselves to apply remedies. Subscriptions were made for the immigrants and merchants bankrupt by the failure of trade. The English spirit awoke to its full activity and, as it had ever done, set itself to resist the evil and to stand in the breach which diseased nature had suffered chaos and death to make in the bounds and banks which had hitherto kept them out. At the commencement of summer, we began to feel that the mischief which had taken place in distant countries was greater than we had at first suspected. Quito was destroyed by an earthquake. Mexico laid waste by the united effects of storm, pestilence, and famine. Crowds of immigrants inundated the west of Europe, and our island had become the refuge of thousands. In the meantime, Ryland had been chosen protector. He had sought this office with eagerness under the idea of turning his whole forces to the suppression of the privileged orders of our community. His measures were thwarted and his schemes interrupted by this new state of things. Many of the foreigners were utterly destitute, and their increasing numbers at length forbade a recourse to the usual modes of relief. Trade was stopped by the failure of the interchange of cargoes usual between us and America, India, Egypt, and Greece. A sudden break was made to the routine of our lives. In vain, our protector and his partisans sought to conceal this truth. In vain, day after day, he appointed a period for the discussion of the new laws concerning hereditary rank and privilege. In vain, he endeavored to represent the evil as partial and temporary. These disasters came home to so many bosoms, and through the various channels of commerce were carried so entirely into every class and division of the community, that of necessity they became the first question in the state, the chief subjects to which we must turn our attention. Can it be true, each asked the other with wonder and dismay, that whole countries are laid waste, whole nations annihilated by these disorders in nature? The vast cities of America, the fertile plains of Hindustan, the crowded abodes of the Chinese are menaced with utter ruin. Where late the busy multitudes assembled for pleasure or profit, now only the sound of wailing and misery is heard. The air is empoisoned, and each human being inhales death, even while in youth and health their hopes are in the flower. We call to mind the plague of 1348, when it was calculated that a third of mankind had been destroyed. As yet, Western Europe was uninfected. Would it always be so? Oh yes, it would, countrymen. Fear not. In the still and cultivated wilds of America, what wonder that among its other giant destroyers, plague should be numbered? It is of old a native of the East, sister of the tornado, the earthquake, and the simoon. Child of the sun, nursling of the tropics, it would expire in these climes. It drinks the dark blood of the inhabitant of the South, but it never feasts on the pale-faced Celt. If perchance some stricken Asiatic came among us, plague dies with him, uncommunicated and innoxious. Let us weep for our brethren, though we can never experience their reverse. Let us lament over and assist the children of the garden of the earth. Late we envied their abodes, their spicy groves, fertile plains, and abundant loveliness. But in this mortal life, extremes are always matched. The thorn grows with the rose, the poison tree and the cinnamon mingle their boughs. Persia, with its cloth of gold, marble halls, and infinite wealth, is now a tomb. The tent of the Arab is fallen in the sands, and his horse spurns the ground unbridled and unsaddled. The voice of lamentation fills the valley of Kashmir. Its dells and woods, its cool fountains and gardens of roses are polluted by the dead. In Circassia and Georgia, the spirit of beauty weeps over the ruin of its favorite temple, the form of woman. Our own distresses, though they were occasioned by the fictitious reciprocity of commerce, increased in due proportion. Bankers, merchants, and manufacturers, whose trade depended on exports and interchange of wealth, became bankrupt. Such things, when they happen singly, affect only the immediate parties, but the prosperity of the nation was now shaken by frequent and extensive losses. Families bred in opulence and luxury were reduced to beggary. The very state of peace in which we gloried was injurious. There were no means of employing the idle, or of sending any overplus population out of the country. Even the source of colonies was dried up. For in New Holland, Van Diemen's Land, and the Cape of Good Hope, plague raged. Oh, for some mechanical vial to purge unwholesome nature and bring back the earth to its accustomed health. Ryland was a man of strong intellects and quick and sound decision in the usual course of things, but he stood aghast at the multitude of evils that gathered around us. Must he tax the land in interest to assist our commercial population? To do this, he must gain the favor of the chief landholders, the nobility of the country, and these were his vowed enemies. He must conciliate them by abandoning his favorite scheme of equalization. He must confirm them in their manorial rights. He must sell his cherished plans for the permanent good of his country for temporary relief. He must aim no more at the dear object of his ambition. Throwing his arms aside, he must, for present ends, give up the ultimate object of his endeavors. He came to Windsor to consult with us. Every day added to his difficulties. The arrival of fresh vessels with immigrants, the total cessation of commerce, the starving multitude that thronged around the palace of the Protectorate were circumstances not to be tampered with. The blow was struck. The aristocracy obtained all they wished, and they subscribed to a 12-month bill which levied 20% on all the rent rolls of the country. Calm was now restored to the metropolis and to the populous cities before driven to desperation, and we returned to the consideration of distant calamities, wondering if the future would bring any alleviation to their excess. It was August, so there could be small hope of relief during the heats. On the contrary, the disease gained virulence, while starvation did its accustomed work. Thousands died unlamented, for beside the yet warm corpse, the mourner was stretched, made mute by death. On the 18th of this month, news arrived in London that the plague was in France and Italy. These tidings were at first whispered about town, but no one dared express aloud the soul-quailing intelligence. When anyone met a friend in the street, he only cried as he hurried on, "You know," while the other, with an ejaculation of fear and horror, would answer, "What will become of us?" At length it was mentioned in the newspapers. The paragraph was inserted in an obscure part. "We regret to state that there can be no longer a doubt of the plague having been introduced at Leghorn, Genoa, and Marseilles." No word of comment followed, and reader made his own fearful one. We were as a man who hears that his house is burning, and yet hurries through the streets, borne along by a lurking hope of a mistake, till he turns the corner and sees his sheltering roof enveloped in a flame. Before it had been a rumor, but now in words unerasable, in definite and undeniable print, the knowledge went forth. Its obscurity of situation rendered it the more conspicuous. The diminutive letters grew gigantic to the bewildered eye of fear. They seemed graven with a pen of iron, impressed by fire, woven in the clouds, stamped on the very front of the universe. The English, whether travelers or residents, came pouring in one great revulsive stream. Back on their own country, and with them crowds of Italians and Spaniards, our little island was filled even to bursting. At first, an unusual quantity of specie made its appearance with the immigrants, but these people had no means of receiving back into their hands what they spent among us. With the advance of summer and the increase of distemper, rents were unpaid, and their remittances failed them. It was impossible to see these crowds of wretched, perishing creatures, late nurslings of luxury, and not stretch out a hand to save them. As at the conclusion of the 18th century, the English unlocked their hospitable store for the relief of those driven from their homes by political revolution. So now they were not backward in affording aid to the victims of a more widespreading calamity. We had many foreign friends whom we eagerly sought out, and relieved from dreadful penury. Our castle became an asylum for the unhappy. A little population occupied its halls. The revenue of its possessor, which had always found a mode of expenditure congenial to his generous nature, was now attended to more parsimoniously, that it might embrace a wider portion of utility. It was not, however, money except partially, but the necessities of life that became scarce. It was difficult to find an immediate remedy. The usual one of imports was entirely cut off. In this emergency, to feed the very people to whom we had given refuge, we were obliged to yield to the plow and to the mattock our pleasure grounds and parks. Livestock diminished sensibly in the country from the effects of the great demand in the market. Even the poor deer, our antlered proteges, were obliged to fall for the sake of worthier pensioners. The labor necessary to bring the lands to this sort of culture employed and fed the outcasts of the diminished manufactories. Adrian did not rest only with the exertions he could make with regard to his own possessions. He addressed himself to the wealthy of the land. He made proposals in Parliament, little adapted to please the rich, but his earnest pleadings and benevolent eloquence were irresistible. To give up their pleasure grounds to the agriculturist, to diminish sensibly the number of horses kept for the purposes of luxury throughout the country, were means obvious but unpleasing. Yet to the honor of the English, be it recorded that although natural disinclination made them delay a while, yet when the misery of their fellow creatures became glaring, an enthusiastic generosity inspired their decrees. The most luxurious were often the first to part with their indulgences. As is common in communities, a fashion was set. The high-born ladies of the country would have deemed themselves disgraced if they had now enjoyed what they before called a necessary, the ease of a carriage. Chairs, as in olden time, and Indian palanquins were introduced for the infirm, but else it was nothing singular to see females of rank going on foot to places of fashionable resort. It was more common for all who possessed landed property to secede to their estates, attended by whole troops of the indigent, to cut down their woods, to erect temporary dwellings, and to portion out their parks, parterres, and flower gardens to necessitous families. Many of these, of high rank in their own countries, now, with hoe in hand, turned up the soil. It was found necessary at last to check the spirit of sacrifice and to remind those whose generosity proceeded to lavish waste that until the present state of things became permanent, of which there was no likelihood, it was wrong to carry change so far as to make a reaction difficult. Experience demonstrated that in a year or two pestilence would cease. It were well that in the meantime we should not have destroyed our fine breeds of horses or have utterly changed the face of the ornamented portion of the country. It may be imagined that things were in a bad state indeed before this spirit of benevolence could have struck such deep roots. The infection had now spread in the southern provinces of France, but that country had so many resources in the way of agriculture that the rush of population from one part of it to another and its increase through foreign immigration was less felt than with us. The panic struck appeared of more injury than disease and its natural concomitants. Winter was hailed a general and never failing physician. The embrowning woods, the swollen rivers, the evening mists, the morning frosts were welcome with gratitude. The effects of purifying cold were immediately felt. and the lists of mortality abroad were curtailed each week. Many of our visitors left us. Those whose homes were far in the south fled delightedly from our northern winter and sought their native land, secure of plenty even after their fearful visitation. We breathed again. What the coming summer would bring, we knew not, but the present months were our own, and our hopes of a cessation of pestilence were high. End of Volume 2, Chapter 5. Recording by Larry Maddox, Salt Lake City, www.relusa.com.
Thank you once again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales. You can find us online at Black Clock Audio Tales on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Meet up with us at pgttcm.com. Find out what's going on with this and other podcasts by Badger Drift Studios, which is where we record this in beautiful North Portland. If you want to be on a show, if you have a book that you would like to have reviewed, if you want to be on Welcome to Portland, eat charcuterie and drink beer in the studio while learning how to podcast, I can accommodate that. But you have to take the first step by going to pgttcm.com and submitting. Send us a link to your stories. Become friends with us on Facebook at pgttcm or Black Clock Audio Tales. And PGTTCM, of course, is short for The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, our monthly show. At the end of every month on Tuesday, we have PGTTCM. Thank you so much for listening. Edited by DB Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, as always. Thank you.